years after, when Anand Swami came into my life, that I found that he was a Saraswati yoga. So, in a way, you say you got put up for it.
I don't know, when I meditate, I reach to a stage that everything started to get dark. Mm-hmm. And then I panic. Something in me pull me out of that stage. I don't know, it's my brain, it's my... I don't know what it does, but, you know. I would stay in that stage for a very short period, and then I can't control it.
Stick with it.
I
know. What you're reliving in that state is the moment when the cord is cut and the baby wants to breathe. The mechanism recalls the panic of shutting down for lack of air. So when you go inwards and you're in the darkness of no geometry, the sensation of being lost comes up from the memory bank of the cells. But keep this in mind, losers can be born. So you made it to be born, therefore you're in the room talking to me. So when you start meditating, you feel this so-called condition coming on. The most important thing to reinforce in your mind is the repetition of the five holy names, which represents the five parts of you: crystal, water, temperature, gas, sonics. This holds a focus so you don't disperse into a quandary of panic. And your brain starts to normalize and keep on centering. So after a while, the darkness will start to phase down, and the sensation of panic will start phasing down. Then you'll be able to go deeper into your consciousness without the panic, and then you'll experience the consciousness moving through to that level like a tunnel. But that's what you have to work with, not to panic, and just repeat the names to get the brain to center. Remember one thing. The panic is only in the photographic process. It's not an actual thing of the body. The actual thing of the body is that you're born. In spite of yourself, you were born. But the photography of going through it is recorded in the cells. So once you know the difference between the two, you just go through it and don't panic. Let me put it this way, the worst could happen, you'll fall asleep and forget till next morning. you start all over again next day. That's the worst that could happen with it. So you see, you only can go two directions, unconscious sleep or conscious watch it through. You see what I mean? So knowing that, then your body don't panic no more. You're actually shifting from the craving for the unconscious to the craving of the conscious. So that particular transition is quite an anguish to the body that is familiar as a child growing up to an adult, going into sleep very automatic. There's no way you can switch on some, you know what I mean? So therefore the body tends to slip into the unconscious, and the sensation of darkness would create that sensation of panic feeling. But if you don't panic and you realize it's from unconscious to consciousness you're dealing with, your body will just flip into the conscious level and We all have to go through that, including myself, so I know what you're going through already, so there's none to worry about. You're just shifting from unconscious to consciousness.
When
Yogananda got the title of Paramahansa. That was sometime in the middle of his life. Okay. What level was he at when he left his body?
He was already an avatar.
He was an avatar.
Unless I misunderstood, which is entirely possible, someone asked Sai Baba, and it was quoted in a book that I read not long ago, about Babaji and him occupying the body for all these many centuries that he had promised, was it his sister, that he would do? And Sai Baba was quoted as having said that that was impossible. And I had a little question about the apparent conflict there.
Well, I can only say this, that's Sai Baba's answer. I can't make a comment or a thing like that. Sai Baba has to give his own answer for what he's basing his own observation on.
Tibetan tradition, Buddhist tradition, you're supposed to be able to remember all your past lives before you reach a certain level. Is there a validity to that? Or?
That's what the Nibbikapa Samadhi is. You see your whole spectrum of yourself. But seeing all the past lives of who you were doesn't change what you are right now. Because what you were contributes to what you are now. And what you are now will contribute to what you will be the next second. So the most important contribution to spirit is your effort now, not what you have done in the past. They are only rungs in the ladder. And the man climbing up the ladder stood at the top and forgot the hammer and the nail that he was supposed to nail sign up with, and the wind blew it away, and you fell down, wondering why did you waste all the time. See what I mean? Mm-hmm. No, it's the practicality of the moment that's more important than the fact that you have all this whole rung of ladder, and looking back, and you forgot the hammer and nail that you originally went to do, nail the sign from before the wind blew it away.
But now, random viewing of past lives through meditation, though, usually triggers an emotional response that is something that's happening right now in your life.
Yeah.
A trauma or...
But you see the thing again, don't confuse the process of enlightenment with the cleaning up. The enlightenment is more important than the cleaning up.
Enlightenment is more important than the cleaning up.
The cleaning up is to prepare you to clean up, to accept enlightenment. But if you're going to worry only of the cleaning up and not end up being enlightened, it's not practical.
Cooking a meal and never eating.
That's right, exactly. See, so if I say, worrying about the rungs in the ladder and forgetting the hammer and nail, which is the intent to nail that sign up so it doesn't fall off the wall, it's exactly what the thing is. You want to finish what you set out to do, so how you get there is secondary. The end, the most important thing is that you did fix the sign. That the important thing in this present form is to realize the shift from the unconscious to the conscious. It doesn't matter how many incarnations you've had prior to now, if none of the incarnations gave you control of the unconscious into the conscious, it would add up. This is the one opportunity again that is presented in the same situation of gaining control over the unconscious with the conscious. So what is more important? The past contributes to where you are to get you to be competent where you are now. But when you, right here, now you have to decide in your mind, do I switch over from unconscious state to conscious control of living and give it all I got? Because what have I got? I've got the fact that I am born a winner. I am the sperm that got here. Regardless of how many times I played a role in previous lives, it didn't give me the comprehension to stick it out, to finish it. So I had to repeat it so many crazy times. And nothing wrong with that. But here now is the moment of the challenge. Here is the moment, the greater glory of God. Not what I did in the past or what my parents did, that I born blind to the reality. The opportunity is I must see through the reality between the unconscious level of myself to the conscious level. I must apply this winningness that this sperm has generated into the ovum to make me a form to live out the confrontation with all the memory of the past, good qualities, but still, here is the test. See what I mean? You can study and study, and the last day of the exam is still the last day of the exam. Do you pass or you fail? So that's where you have to focus. Like not too long ago, somebody, I took up an exam, and they were reviewing all the questions they were going to ask. And so they said to me, I don't think I'm going to pass. I said, what are you worrying about? All I ask you is to go through the thing, and if you get passing grade, that's all, that you don't do the second time. So they went through the, we waited outside, and when they came out, and they told me the questions they asked, they said, I don't think, and I asked all the answers they gave me. They said, well, you see, I didn't answer it that way. I said, oh, you answered. So when they, I said, well, you'll get passing grade. Turned out, they got passing grade, and they got their license and everything. And the people who think they had the right answer had the wrong answer. So that's what I'm trying to tell the person. It says, regardless of how much it is, don't do it a second time. Try to work with it, go through it, and leave it to the. Because a diploma never says you pass it A, B, or C. It says you stuck it out, and that's what's more important. You start, and eventually, as you keep sticking things out, you get better and better. But you have to build up this intent, this consciousness of it, sticking things out. Then the grays go up. As long as you don't tell yourself that you want to do it a second time, you will improve. But if you want to tell yourself you're going to do it a second time, you'll always go back. But just go through the process. That's the whole idea behind it. It's the same with the meditation. You got many incarnations to go back and forth to achieve this enlightenment. And it's never told to us in simple language what the enlightenment really boils down to mean. It boils down to mean that I can disengage from an unconscious level in a 24-hour cycle that replenishes my mechanism to a conscious 24-hour cycle that replenishes my mechanism. I'll give you an example. Years ago, I was invited, like a little group here, going to Charleston, South Carolina, and some people had invited me up there to come. And I arrived, and they picked me up at the airport, and they took me to this place. And the first person that brought me there started talking and asking questions. The questions went on for 8 hours straight. Then I noticed he rolled over and started to sleep in the corner, and another one in the group started questioning, and he went on for 8 hours straight. By that time I caught on to the technique of what they want to do. So, okay, in my head, I said, you guys didn't know what you pick up to do that. But I kept my mouth shut. So the second one rolled over after 16 hours, the third one pick up. And he kept on for 8 hours straight. So I've gone 24 hours with questions. And the whole group is rotating this 8 hours. And I'm laughing to myself. The because the second thread, the four hours is coming up now, and each one did the trick. This is 48 hours, pure answers, questioning. Comes the 72 hours. They started to ask questions and they all sunk out, sunk asleep at the first 8 hours. So I'm sitting back and I'm relaxing. We got, this is 24, 48 hours, and 8 hours is 56 hours. 56 hours of question and answer, and they're all zonked out on the floor, sunk asleep because of.
And you're still bright.
I'm still there, relaxing and laughing. So when they woke up, I said, "What happened?" I said, "Well, I think your game did work, but it worked against you." I said, "See, you were living under the impression that this Swami who did all this type of meditation is some kind of a mental game. You don't realize it's a biological physics of work. So now that you've encountered it yourself, you apply the process and not imagine." It was funny. Years after I met the three fellows, and they have really improved from anything.
What is the most effective way to pray for others?
The most effective way to pray for others? I wish them their highest good. Now think of what I said. I wish them their highest good, simply because Jesus said, "To the greater glory of God, and greater things shall you do." These two statements indicate that to want others, you want what is their highest in them, because it's God. And who is praying in the first place for who? God is praying for God in the other person with the notion that the other person is what, deficient. So the prayer is the one who thinks they're efficient and they got access to what, power, to the one who don't seem to have any. So that would be erroneous. But if you say you wish them the highest good, automatically you cancel out in your mind any inadequacy that you are praying for them, or you're motivating any kind of love. You're relating or recognizing the creative intelligence in everything, including yourself. So in truth, is that to pray for their highest good is to see the God in them. And that will automatically resolve the resistances that they suffer from. At the same time, it will free you from your own self-imposed restrictions about what you are to yourself, or what you feel you have to do, thinking it is necessary to do it. The biggest thing that can happen to us is the ego not knowing how it's trapping itself out of frustration and the anguish to be willing to helping others. So you don't want to get trapped in that type of frustration. So anytime you see someone, first you have to establish in your mind that it's God. And their own resistance is blocking, which is their individuality. It's blocking their God nature. And it's your God nature that's reaching out. That's why you feel compassion and you want to exercise it. So to avoid making it an ego game in your head and it not working out when you're asking for it to, and is to only want the highest good in them,
And in that way, you free yourself from any ego reaction, or even if you're let down by this particular ego drive to do something, you couldn't be let down by wanting their highest good. See, their highest good is also your highest good. That's why Jesus said, the things I do, you will do also, and greater things shall you do. Now, if he had said, I'm not greater than me, that would place the truth that he is the only Son of God, and there is no one can aspire to this particular state. And therefore, Son of God is not a statement. Son of God would be a person. But since he is emphasizing, the things I do, you shall do also, and greater things shall you do, places the concept of Son of God as a principle locked up in every human being, which is the highest good of every human being. So if he said, and greater things shall you do, this would be automatically a lifting up quality for him also. By wishing you greater things than himself, who are you going to give thanks to when it happens? Back to the person who wishes, see? So they automatically build in their own what? Highest proportion. And that's basically what you do. You wish them their highest good, which automatically feeds back on your highest good. So don't get trapped in a prayer or what you have to say in a prayer. The idea that you want the highest good of the other person. And you see that in them. It will automatically build its own magnetic attraction. The body gets tired from wrong input and wrong thought processes. Now, I have done both. Eat food, exercise, and have energy. Did a lot of work. And live with the impression that that is the truth about the body. Then I did the reverse. Didn't eat, did lots of work, and didn't feel tired. Then I went on a fast. I was weighing 180 pounds at the time. And so I fasted for 28 days, and I lost about 30 pounds. I came down to 150. So I was so happy. Fasting, losing all this weight. I said, I'm going to keep on going till I get down to the weight I want to be. It was over 130. The next 28 days, I didn't eat, I worked, and I all came back. Yeah. And that taught me a lesson. If I ate or I didn't eat, or I had a pulse was there, showing me that it was neither of the two. I got the 180 pounds, it went right on back, and I didn't eat. So there I realized that it wasn't the body, or the, it was the attitude. So when you shift your attitude from relying on unconscious levels for vitality, it will constantly reinforce itself every 24 hours for you to what? Want to shut down to sleep to vitalize that, because it's a program pattern, it's a form of self-induction. And if you gradually break away from that association, you have to use words like, I'll be more alert. So here is, I'm alive, alert, awake, and enthusiastic all the time. See, then I don't have any way to say I'm going to go to sleep at all. The reversal of ideas, of instead of saying, I need to go to sleep, not to wake up tomorrow, those terms tend to make the body crave to sleep. And then you have to switch around to find words in which there is no input of craving sleep as a source of replenishing energy. Well, let's look at the physics of Einstein's physics. Energy is equal to the mass times the velocity of light squared. That's the formula, right? Are you familiar with that? Good. Your mass is 144 elements. And your velocity is the respiratory rate of the speed of light squared. So where are you going to lose energy and gain it now? But your fixation that you have to sleep to replenish your energy is going to make you feel tired, or your fixation that you don't have to sleep is going to free you from your tired. So wherever you fixate to replenish the 144, which isn't going any place, that's the thing. You see, the research is showing that the brain responds to sonic resonances and releases the flow. So the endorphins that are there to heal you, if you're over-programmed to shutting down and sleeping for them to do their job, that's what you're going to need to feel, and so you're going to run to the hospital for it. If you don't feel that's where it has to come from, and it has to come from within the structure of a conscious application, then the endorphins will automatically start releasing. So the ancient people saw this particular principle locked up in the body, and the spoken word was the actual switch between unconscious shutdown as a source of replenishment versus conscious relationship as a source of replenishment.
The most physical thing that's happening is that actually both ways,
yeah.
Both thinking and
right. But you see, we come in first in an unconscious relationship as a human body evolving through the fetus to be born, to sleep, and to grow up. And then the parent reinforcing that condition for 18 years in our life. Then we have to switch away from that. But that's valid to go through that level. A chicken don't hatch another chicken right out. You have to lay an egg first. And then you have to go through the process of converting the egg into a chicken. See, and that's exactly what we got. We don't come in conscious in a state that we can communicate conscious with our parents. We come through this withdrawal level, and then we're working through the non-withdrawal.
Could you share with us your experience of Jesus manifesting with you?
I fell off a building years ago. That's when I had my first experience with him. And I saw him standing there with Yogananda and all of them, and looking at me with their eyes. So don't. One thing about these realized masters, they're in their atomic body nature, which can appear to be visible or invisible at will, and can be felt and touched as flesh, but they don't interfere, and they don't talk with them out. That's the notion we get. We think they're talking with them out, but they're actually talking with their eyes. They look at you, and the beam of energy that the idea that you're expecting them to say flows through into your brain, so it's automatic. Like if they're reading your mind and answering you before you ask the question. And the answer was, what do you want? Here you are, fall down. And they are there. And from my expectation that these holy beings are supposed to help people in quandary. And so when they stand up with their eyes all radiating, what you want, you don't know what to say now. So they move your consciousness to look at yourself. And what I saw was, I have a broken body with the unfinished thought patterns that I have to resolve. Then I'm looking at the future body because I know it's broken. And this is, there's no way I'm going to stop the process of nature's laws. If it's broken, it's going to either be buried or be healed. Now, 9 times out of 10, your ego is so great to have these great beings perform miracles to heal you in your ignorance. So this is what my brain will go through. I'm ignorant to fall off a building, so please now, your God, do something, save me. But then they're showing me my ignorance as if they show me understanding. I see my body broken up. Then I'm seeing another body waiting in the distance that is being formed, and that would represent returning back to life again via the womb. And the eyes are only saying, what do you want? Now, I finally realized that they were not going to do anything without my comprehension. And it's my free decision to react. Not my will, but thy will be done again. So I came to the observation that I'm familiar. This is the understanding level. I'm familiar with this broken body. And therefore, being familiar with it, I have two choices, to reject it and start over fresh with a new body not familiar with, or go through the familiar body and suffer the agony of the pain of the brokenness in the body that I'm familiar with. I know it's broken, I can't avoid looking at the bones are broken, but I know the agony of the pain, and I'm being temporarily suspended from the agony by being oxygenating my mechanism, looking outside of it. I see that as a function. And then the other one is the loss of the memory of going through the womb to be born, to grow up, to be re-educated again, versus here is a broken body and it's going to be in a state of pain. Well, the decision is forming in my brain. Finally, I said to myself, I prefer my broken body because I'm familiar with it. It might have been a fixation, it may not be a fixation, but the decision was one in which familiarity is far more nurturing than non-familiarity. You're not so liable to miscalculate when you're familiar with certain things, other than when you're unfamiliar, you're liable to make incorrect decisions. So I accept my familiarity with my body, even though it's broken, knowing it's going to have the pain. I accepted that as a means of working back through it. Then the face of Jesus and the whole body, all of them start to phase out. But then I could feel my body now getting numb from the foot coming up, right up to the chest, and I tried to feel, couldn't feel anything, it's just numb. And then I'm looking at the height of the building I fell, and all of a sudden in my head I can hear the voices say, if the numbness passes your eyes, you will be dead. There's nothing they can do or would do. So for that reason I said, I got to stay awake till I get medical help. The numbness had already come past my chest, getting up the nose. The mouth is already numb. But if it passed my eyes, it was over. I'd be unconscious, and then I wouldn't have any control. So I grabbed my hand, which I couldn't even feel it, and I put my finger in my mouth with one thought in mind to create pain. Now, think of that. I'm going to create pain. The laws of physics, something is working inside. It seems kind of crazy when I start biting, until I felt the first sensation of the pain, the head reacted. And I kept biting to feel the sensation of pain. Then I noticed the more I bite, the numbness started to receding down. And I kept on biting, I could feel the teeth biting. And the numbness came and stopped right here. Wouldn't go any further down, no matter how hard I bit the finger. But from here up, I was clear, clear, clear. My memory and everything was working complete like that. At that time, the ambulance came, and they lifted me up and put me in the ambulance, and they rode to the hospital. I'm recording everything in my consciousness, as clear as everything. But every time I tried to pull the finger out in the mouth to let go, the whole body started getting numb again. The numbness starts to rise up. So I knew the only way I could stay conscious was to maintain the pressure of the biting on the finger till I got to the hospital. And then the nurse comes up and she said, you're funny, Jim, you're going to pull me out. She stands up, what's your name, where are you from?
Oh,
and she's going through all kinds of there, you know. And the doctor in attendance, the intern said, nurse, this man is dying. Please, we'll get that information later. Let's get him into the emergency. So it was funny. Yogananda had passed away in 52, and I was already teaching meditation for his organization. And Kriyananda came to see me because he wanted to see the man that Yogananda didn't want to come to visit, SRF. And he arrived Monday, and he told me he was having an initiation that night, and if I could come to the initiation, it's general for the public. And since he knew I didn't go to SRF, it would be an honor to him to visit. So I went the Monday night to the initiation, and then the Tuesday I was fixing up my store. And that Wednesday my lawyer asked me to help him install a TV he had bought for his mother, was the first one. And in that part of the country, the TV was just coming in, and we would install the antenna and everything. So I said, fine. But during the day of the Wednesday, I was saying to myself, I have come this far in my meditation. I think I'm ready for all my karma. Well, I'll tell you this, don't ask me, because you don't even know what you're saying to yourself. Sometimes ignorance is your worst enemy, your best friend. So that during the day was what I was asking for. I should. And that night, the rain had fallen a little, and I was wearing one of those rubberized shoes, what do you call it? The claw shoe.
Yachting,
yeah. And I was on the balcony, we were putting up the antenna, and I slipped from the water and the balcony being wet, and my back hit the railing, and the railing was rotten and broke. Mm-hmm. But I didn't realize I was falling three stories. The house was a three-story house, and each story is a 10, those houses are built 10 feet high, not like an 8-foot house today. This is a new for measurements, but they used to be 10 feet, so it was 30 feet I was falling to the ground. And while falling, with the antenna ripped with my holding on, something in my brain says, kick the wall or you'll be dead. Never realizing what it's for. So I did like that with my left foot against the wall of the house, and I veered in the fall. And when I landed, it's when I went back after I came out of the hospital to where the Piedmont police poured this stuff in to take measurements of fall, I saw I was exactly 6 inches total outline of my body in the mud, away from the concrete walkway around the house. Mm-hmm. Now, if I didn't kick and veered, I'd be landing directly on the concrete walkway. Mm-hmm. Then I wouldn't be talking to you. Mm-hmm. So some ways, a lot of compensations were going on.
Have you ever regretted the pain and stuff, the decision?
No, I put it this way, I didn't expect it. But I wouldn't say I regret it. I didn't expect it. And in the process of the being fortunate and thankful for having been exposed to a way of spiritual life that was not normal and wouldn't be considered normal in those days, like today most people talk of gurus, and in those days a guru was a hard thing to hear about. Mostly I went to church and that's it. And I came into a spiritual life by coming in the roundabout way through a guru attitude, and to see that there was some context of validity in the thing when the injury occurred, and to see that this truth of communion of saints is a valid process. But one doesn't really see that when one is healthy, and it doesn't have much to say that you're going to pursue it when you're healthy without conviction. When you hurt your body, and then to realize the brief moment between phasing out or continuing, that this existence of beings and their actual influence on the planet is valid. It changes your whole perspective of yourself and everything. You want to live more than want to phase out. You realize, hey, wait a minute, I'm missing the boat, because this is real. This is not a book, or it's not something somebody made up. It's a prayer. This is more than just a prayer. I may fool myself with the hypnosis, but this is not, because they are here. But it's not how the way they act, it's not how they write about it. And so it's a different education altogether. They didn't say they're going to come and bless you, go and so on that. They just said they were there, and you're in communication with it. And that they were involved in the forgiveness of sin, but you may have the erroneous notion what forgiveness of sin is. See, when you understand what it was involved, you see why they are there. So it's valid to say, I believe or I accept the communication of saints, that is the reality of beings who have achieved enlightenment, and the forgiveness of sins, which is the resolving of misapplied decisions. When that actual truth comes into your life and frees you from the preconceived versions of what you think it represents, it's a vast cleaning up of your brain, and you phase out a lot of impractical ideas about what a thing really is. And then you begin to see the difference between churchianity and spirituality. Churchianity has a role to play to get people interested, to clean up their act. But when they're going through the process, then the actual wisdom, the actual enlightenment comes in terms of physics for the first time. Your brain starts to relate, to see the truth, that these beings do exist, and they have a quality that is in us already, and they're only reminding us of it. And then what is it that block us from applying it is our own versions of mistakes. So to make you feel penitent or consistent, you may use a term like sin, but after you realize that's not a practical term no more, because it can lead to fanatical behavior, then you realize it's decisions that you've been making and evading and putting off, and they're incorrect. And then you start to accept the commitment of acting what you say, which is a tremendous transformation. But then you see that at the same time, it's a compensation, it's grace. If it was totally cut off, it would be very, very traumatic in the whole thing. But it's not. That's what's so beautiful.
that this creative principle puts us through this process, and then we have a compensation, a sort of a second chance to really reevaluate and live. So it has opened my consciousness more in that direction to appreciate what these beings are. But as far as saying that interfering or that, no, you have to really reach the level of, and they don't really interfere, because actually who heal who? You're healing yourself. All the miraculous healing. And what would have happened, this is the thing. I was in the hospital after I arrived there and began to see how daily events right there were taking place in a miraculous way. Because when I got to the hospital, the doctor who became my surgeon, I arrived at that. He came down the elevator and he came out and he saw what his interns were doing, and he took away the scalpel. He says, "This man is dying." He stuck me in the rib and let the air out. Then he looked at me and says, "Young man, normally I don't come down this elevator. It's only because it didn't work tonight. Of all the nights of the elevator, the one that he normally goes from the surgery office didn't work. And he had to backtrack and come through that one." And I said, "Yeah, Doc." And thankfully he had to come there, because these interns didn't know I was dying from bloating up from the brain. Going to get pain, and he's coming out of his unconsciousness. So he told the nurse, "I want you to give him this much morphine every hour to phase down the pain." And I said, "Doc, I don't want no medicine, no drug in my body." And he says to the nurse, "If, don't give it to him if he doesn't want it." And so he walked away, and she said to me, "You doggone Orientals think it tough, eh?" I said, "No, I'm going to grin and bear it." She said, "Okay, we can see." She walked away, and the pain came on. Now this is the thing. The pain came on, and I'm groaning, and then I'm remembering old cowboys' pictures. How to fight pain is to put something in your mouth and bite. So I reach over and I'm pulling up the pillow and I'm biting. And I'm perspiring like crazy from the pain. And she comes over and sees me groaning, and she got the needle. "Just stick the needle." "And no, no." And she walked off. Well, the pain went on for 4 straight hours. And she thought I was crazy, gone. They took off my stuff to soak me wet. But I was fighting the pain. Finally, the room started to fade away in the pain. I was getting to the point. And I could see the scar. And along the scar, I saw a woman walking towards me. And I still got the bed pillow sheet in my head, and I'm looking. And along comes this, and I thought it was a nun. And it comes and stopped right at the foot of my bed. Then I realized, I've seen this person before. Yeah, where did I? Oh yes, when I was a child in South America, in a church, in a Catholic church where I grew up, this statue. That's a whole life-size, but that's a life-size statue of Mary. Well, Mary's came in like that. Her eyes are closed, right at the foot of the bed. So I thought it was a statue. I'm looking, and then all of a sudden I'm saying to myself, "Please open your eyes, please open your eyes, please open your eyes." If it's a statue, you know, I can feel. Then the eyes open, then you can see the flesh. And I knew it wasn't a statue. And it was the eyes again. They don't seem to talk with their mouth. The eyes send the message, "You will be well, but not dramatically." And that was the message. And I didn't know the difference of dramatic wellness or well. I only wanted to be well. Well, this is what happened. As she started to dissolve in or shrink down in size from a life size down, the pain started to shift away from my body. All from the head, going right down, and going right down to the foot. By the time her body was like a little speck in the distant in the corridor, the pain was going out of my toe. And I let out a yell. I think Tarzan can yell. I yell Tarzan. "I am well, I am well, I am well."
And the doctors come running up and say, this guy's crazy. Well. So they took the measurements. Everything is reading normal. But then I remember the last statement, not dramatically. The doctors are puzzled. They couldn't understand why everything is functioning in the blood pressure thing going, but there I am. And I realized, why not dramatically? Dramatically would mean the bones that were broken would automatically heal and hold, and I would be able to get up to walk. But then, it would be dramatic in that hospital because I'd be the walking way. Got it. Ripley, believe it or not, kind of a freak, because who's going to let you out after a thing like that, knowing they got all the x-rays, and in a Catholic environment? You really will be a freak, then. But I didn't get well dramatically. I had to work through the process. Years I have to come to understand a lot more of my body. So I see why I came back into the body, to relate to people who were not even born yet in the process.
We had a lady here in Tucson last week who's president or something of the Atheist Party. How would you address somebody like that? Or how would you, I'm not saying argue with her, but certainly the things that she says and the things that she believes are totally foreign to us. And she's making a pretty big impact on the community. She's right now after the prayer in school.
What is her main argument?
That God doesn't exist. You know, she's doing her best to spread that message.
Well, I can understand her fixation that he may not exist, how she's been programmed, that is somebody sitting on a throne in some antiseptic corner of the universe. Therefore, that would be her fixation of trying to break down that kind of an image. Because most of us coming in childhood get that kind of impression from our parents and a lot of our communal thinking that he's somebody on the throne. And when you try to relate in a moment of illness and it doesn't come true, you are totally devastated, and if you find you do something that's totally unconventional to get your health back, what's the first thing you're going to do? Throw your verbal stone at their verbal image and try to wreck it. So I can understand her fixation for it.
Well, I don't have any problem with hers for herself, but you know, she's doing an awful lot to expand on that, to perpetuate that. And what she's targeting right now are little kids who are really in the formative years of their thinking process.
Yeah. Well, look at it another way. She may be the incentive to making children and adults go into themselves to find the real God that would rebuke her in her rejection of the God. And when they come out capable of fulfilling their godlike qualities, then she may phase out. So, in a way, she is their thorn, right? She is their purpose of turning them inward to themselves. So she may have a role of awakening people to themselves. It just could be somebody saying, God is every day, and everybody's turned away from it because you can't see him. So either way, they're playing a role to make human beings look into themselves. Put it this way, 1955, was my accident on the 22nd of June. And so this year is the first June that I had a full moon on the 22nd. So, but the funny part is that when I fell off the building and I was given the opportunity to live again by taking up my broken body, I was lying on the back and I saw a kite running from my tummy into the sky. And my face was on the kite, and on the tail of the kite, like little strings attached, but there were faces all along the tail of the kite flying. And I was looking at them the other strangest way, and many of those faces I later came to meet after I got well from my accident. And I'd say this much, your faces were on the tail of the kite. There's no accident to me. They're all part of the process. You see, because when I fell off the building, I was asking for all my karma. And then, then I realized what a stupid question it was to ask for it, and Yogananda granted it by letting me experience it, only to realize that by asking for all your karma, we don't take into consideration the injuries and the implications of the broken body and the life sequences that are involved in a karmic statement. We so carry with intellect more than understanding. And so it's not something I recommend to anybody who but I have to go through it and appreciate it. But the people that I was to meet in this present life are involved in the karma. So because you don't meet anyone unless you have a karmic pattern. And there are only two types of people you can meet. A younger person than yourself or an older person than yourself. And there are only two ways of communication to establish what the karma is. If a young person comes to you, and in my case, if I spoke to the young person first, then that's previous life karma. Or if I spoke to an older person first, but I didn't have too many older persons come into my life, that I would speak to them first. They usually spoke to me first. Or whether. So that's a previous life karma. When I encounter a young person, they automatically spoke to me without I even making an attempt. That is what we call spermal confrontation. Spermal confrontation is at the time of the release of the sperms going to the ovum, I being the winner in order to have this body with that particular ovum in that particular race, had to leave behind other sperms who couldn't make it. And in their anguish of being thrown out without their consent, they are saying to the winning sperm, "Will you tell daddy off? Why you threw us out?" So this is a biological photography memory bank condition. We don't realize it until we go through the growth and come back. And then when you run into a young person, maybe 8, 10, 20, and his eyes are intently looking at you, and he's got something that you can't seem to resolve. He wants to tell you off in some way, you never met him, and he's, then you know it's a formal consultation. Did you tell daddy off? Well, not too long ago, I run into some of these spermal confrontations. And one is the most comical one was, I was in Houston, and myself and Ed Bergstrom and Melissa, we went into this Chinese store. And the store is packed with a lot of people. And there's a little boy, he's 8 years of age. And his father is over in one end, and his mother's one end working. And the other people are around, men, women, all national. And he walks around, and he walks right up to me and says, "Are you Chinese?" I didn't even say a single thing to him, but of all the people he singled out is me. I says, "No, I'm not Georgian.
I'm Korean."
You can see an old soul in young body, you know, it's a little kid, but and he goes through a whole state of questions, and then and I tell him no. He says, "Well, my dad may be running the store, but mother sure runs it better than him. And I'm here to see nobody, don't take anything off the shelf."
That's the conversation.
And he says, "You sure I don't know you?" Ed is looking at me and saying, "Boy, that's a spurful confrontation." And he said, then finally he said, "Are you from Hong Kong?" He's even going to the, I said, "Where are you going?" He said, "Hong Kong." But this is what I can say, a spurful confrontation of the feeling was there, you know it's there at the biological level. It was one of the sperms in the previous, when we were released to go to the oval, and I being the winner, he had to be cycled off. So the energy that was in it went back through the process, and therefore it has to come back in some form to confront me again. So it picked up where it left off, and then of all the places, I was born in South America, he's born in Hong Kong, but he's living in Houston, Texas, and I'm living in Houston, Texas, so we converge right at his father's store. It's interesting. This is how these laws work, and it takes you by it. So when a young child confronts you, you know, it's a spermal confrontation. When an elderly person confronts you, the past life, or if you speak first to the person, it's past life. Or if you speak first to the young child, it's past life. But he's speaking first to you, or she's speaking first to you, it's sperma. See, that's the gap of the age, time lapse. So we don't have something for nothing. Everything is valid.
If in one incarnation you are an initiate, and that body phases out, when you come in the next time, must you start from scratch, or do you carry over some understanding from the first initiate?
You carry over some understanding. You don't lose out.
But in the outer, you must start again and go through the first initiation in the physical.
Well, let me give you an example. Jesus and John. And in the previous incarnation, John was Elijah, and Jesus was Elias the student. Now, Elijah was doing the initiation at the time in the previous incarnation and bestowing the inward power to those who were ready. The student, Elias, didn't have the length of time spent to meditate or warrant a blessing to push his head into a deeper level of awareness. So he asked the teacher for a double portion. Now, come on, give me a boost. Let me get up there. And so the teacher said, "You ask a hard thing," which means that you don't understand what you're asking for. And if you did realize what you're asking for, you're really going to have to pay the price. But the teacher is one type of person who never refuses anybody, but always have to put them under testing process. So that's what a student doesn't realize, why a teacher really can't bestow cosmic consciousness on them if they're not ready. and if they don't want to go through the testing of their own self. So then he asked for a double portion of the power. He wanted this power to come in without even making any attempt to meditate for it. So the teacher says, you ask a hard thing, and in fact you really don't know who it belongs to. It may not belong to you to have it. Somebody over there in the room may be much more advanced than you and is entitled to have this power. But you jump in the gun, and you're, in a sense, you're violating the traditional rule of order of progression of growth. And what? That's getting around this particular comprehension of how things have to work in order. But nevertheless, if you see me before I go, it's yours, meaning I'm not going to reject your requests. I respect your requests, your enthusiasm, your great devotion, but you gotta work hard. And the working hard is to see me before I go. Now, the student may think he's up there and he can keep track of his guru's presence in 24 hours. Then you're gonna find out if you can really go down into all the delta levels. So the teacher say, yeah, okay. If you see me before I decide to shift out of this frame, it's yours. Meaning that you can track now and stay alert. Well, that was a test he had. And he did see the teacher, and the teacher gave him the power. But he has to come back in the next incarnation to resolve it, because why? He violated certain rules that he didn't have the right to do, even though by compensation the teacher gave it to him. He has to rectify it. And who does he have to rectify? He has to rectify it to the person who he deprived, that was entitled to that power by natural development. And he had to face the individual present there who will pinpoint or remind him that he was violating certain rules. So two men were involved when he came back. He came back as Jesus, and Elijah had to come back as John to play the rigmarole of the game to resolve it. And so when John came first before Jesus, he was born before Jesus, and he lived by the River Jordan, and he went about baptizing by water, which is the outward formal initiation without the transference of the energy. So he says, I baptize you by water, but there come one who will baptize you by his Holy Spirit, meaning he will give you the inner turning on of the energy inside. So when Jesus went to the river, this was the first remark he made. There is no man born of woman greater than John, who is Elijah that has come. How would he be able to say that unless he knew it from inside? That this was his own guru from the previous life, but here to make restitution. And John rebuked him, no. He says, you baptize me. And John said, no, you baptize me. Well, picture two grown guys arguing who should throw water at each other's head. If that was really what it was involving. It was a realignment of the roles of the previous life. But Jesus, though given the power to carry on in the previous incarnation from the teacher, realized that he took it. He didn't really earn it in the true sense of the sequential development. He did it through his own ego. Now he's trying to realign it back in order and make restitution for it. And that's a very subtle karmic debt. So he says to the teacher, suffer it to be so. You baptize me. In other words, you perform the act. I'm not trying to usurp any rule. In other words, I want to make restitution. Suffer it to be so. In other words, endure the fact that you are the head. You have been given over the power. I am the one who you know legitimately is to carry on. But go ahead, establish credence. Give me some credibility. Like a diploma from a school is a credibility to the role in which you're playing. So John went ahead and baptized him, or initiated him, and then John saw and heard this particular consciousness resounding. This is my beloved son in whom I'm well pleased, meaning I am glad as a realized master now to make the restitution for this realized student who is going to perform in proper sequence and not get it wrong like he did before. That's why it's called my beloved son. This principle is the right way of step by step. Anyway, the two people that he had to resolve was Judas, the one that betrayed him, they say. Oh, really? It was what he betrayed in the previous life for asking for something that didn't belong to him. He broke a rule. See? And really the man, Judas, who came back with Judas, was the man who was entitled to that quality. And so he was deprived. So he had to come back to confront him in a sort of a game called betrayal. And the thief on the cross was the one who had to remind him that he took something, and so he comes as a role as a thief. But he was not a thief as we know a thief to be, because in those days, if you stole something as a thief, they cut your hand off. They're not going to crucify you. So what kind of thief was that man? He was what you would call a rebellion person, or somebody confronting the Roman government because he didn't want their country to be taken away. So they were classified as thieves, robbing the Roman army, the Roman caravans, to give back to the poor people. And they were all working for Barabbas, the rebel. So they were how they used to treat them in those days. And crucifying them was instituted by Julius Caesar when Spartacus broke away as a slave to free himself from the Roman Empire. And then Julius Caesar went out to punish these men and to make them an example that nobody rebels against Rome anymore. So he strung them all out on crosses along the Appian Way and crucified them. But in those days, crucifixion was not killing you instantly, but letting you die on a cross like that by breaking your bones. So that was the punishment. So these were the ways that Jesus had to work through back to resolve the karma of the power entrusted in him. He came back. He resolved the anguish with Judas, because then Judas apparently went through the role of saying he was betraying him. He knew that there was no real betrayal there. He deliberately commits suicide in the middle of the road so everybody could see him. They said he hung himself on a tree in the middle of the road. And then at the moment when Jesus gave up the body on the cross, they said the veil of the temple rent asunder. But at the same moment, Judas' body burst asunder too, because they said Judas not only hung himself, but his body rent asunder. So he was freed from the karmic implication by Jesus. So they wouldn't have any body to relate to as a person punishing himself from suicide. So he was released from that. Then the thief on the cross, there were two of them. One was saying, if you're so great, why don't you come off the cross? And he said, you don't have to. But then he turns to him and says, Master, remember me when thou comest into thy kingdom. Of all the people who were asking Jesus that, not even his own disciples, Peter didn't even ask him for a thing like that. And this guy is on a cross and saying to him, and using the word master, he's not even saying sir or great one, he's referring to him as master, indicating he understood from the deep levels of his being who this person really was. And so he said, remember me. In other words, do you remember where we met before? And he says, verily, verily, meaning, yes, I know. But this verily is inferring, I know from way back in past lives. And then the commitment is given, you and I shall be in paradise. On this day, on this very moment, just anybody else, you and I shall be in paradise. Well, where is paradise? For most people, paradise is someplace. When in actuality, paradise means beyond desire. At this very moment, you and I will be beyond desire, because desire is the only thing that brings us and locks us into the body to function. And you're in a desireless state. There's nothing here to be paying for or be committed to. There's no karmic debt, because you're desireless, you're free. So most people are locked into the attachment of their desire. So he had to free this particular person who was studying to be a realized person in a previous life with him, to gain the enlightenment, and he got the enlightenment given to him because of his rambunctiousness of asking for it without really working for it. Well, everybody had supposed to work for it. They say, like, he said, I know the teaching, I want to get a high grade pass, and I really don't want to go to school. That's the kind of a ringing, how would you call it, ringing who you know. Well, that's what he had to pay the price. And the price he pays back is to this other student by saying, yes, I'll free you. You don't have to go through the trials of meditating. I'm releasing you of it. So, verily, verily, I say unto you, meaning, because I have the power of the spoken word, I can make the contribution. I was given the power of the spoken word in the previous life, which you might have observed the cry from somebody else. All this I'm making is, verily, verily, it's at this moment you and I will be in power. I'm giving you this opportunity. So he did give him the opportunity. And they said that the body of that saint, that thief, never did rot on the cross. But again, a lot of these things were unusual phenomena in those days because they were never seen as something common until it happened. Even when Stephen was stoned, his body didn't break down when the dogs tried to eat him. So somebody was able to catch up the part of the anatomy that was safe before the dogs had fed. And that portion to this day is the hand. The hand of Stephen is still existing. That shows no sign of decomposition. What we're trying to point out is that the human mechanism carries this principle in it. But again, we come back to two things. The resistance to the fixations that we build up about ourselves that we have to break down. And what is the transition? The transition in the development is from the unconscious level of rejuvenation to the conscious level of rejuvenation. And Jesus was trying to bring that understanding. That's why he called it life abundant. Come that you may have life more abundantly. My God is of the living and not of the dead. Now, how can God be of the dead and we feel that when we sound asleep and unconscious, get replenished when we wake up? Do you see how that is an illusion? If God is of the living, meaning you have to be conscious, and conscious replenishment is more truthful than unconscious replenishment, which is deluding you to believe that you're replenishing and you're not really replenishing. Life is conscious, life is not unconscious. And we function between two states, an unconscious level to replenish the body, or a conscious level to replenish the body. If we rely on the unconscious level to replenish the body, we are not really loving God. Because the teacher is saying, my God, or my view of God, is of the living, meaning on the conscious replenishment level. It's not on the unconscious replenishment level. So because that would be of the dead. When you're sound asleep and you don't wake up, what are they going to do with you? See, and that's why I asked the question, when you're sound asleep, do you know if you're a man or a woman? That's the unconscious relationship with life. And that's not valid because it will let you down. Conscious relationship is it that you be conscious in the process and replenish yourself.
What's going on then while you're asleep? Anything at all? Or are you really checked out totally?
When you're sound asleep, you know exactly that you don't have no connection with anything because memory is shut off. And if they say the person died in the sleep, they didn't wake up. And before it happened, if you were to ask that person, do they know who they are when they're sound asleep? They may say yes or no, and if they say no, you know that if they don't wake up tomorrow after they went to sleep tonight, they're never going to know at all. There is no way that the unconscious person can be considered realized. Realized means to be conscious.
So as long as you think you require sleep, that means you can't be realized.
The body is evolving through that particular process from birth to adulthood, utilizing an unconscious source to replenish and then to phase out from an unconscious source to a conscious source to replenish. Therefore, we don't seek enlightenment when we're born. We don't seek enlightenment when we're healthy. We seek enlightenment after we're born and when we're sick. So this is the why we have to go through that process.
What are dreams?
Oh. It has many connotations, but it boils down to one simple fact. They are misindexed photographic images that the brain has stored prior to sleep and are not in the correct index box. So the time you slow the brain down, they all are jumbled up in the theta level of the brain, not in the delta. They sublimate into delta for the first 7.5 years, causing a schizophrenic condition. But they play themselves out as image patterns in theta. Now, by the same token, they have incentives for self-improvement, which you call visions. But that's bordering on convex relationship of seeing through matter into time. So there is also a bridge between the time lapse of when you see into time and when you relate to the memory.
There's two different.
Yeah. But life is but an empty
kettle.
The poet says life is but an empty dream. He couldn't find anything to relate to life. That's why he wrote it. He said, life is but an empty dream. Now, take a dream and empty it out. What do you have? You have respiration. Life or respiration is but an imageless process. That's another way of saying it. Life is nothing but an empty dream, meaning there are no images in respiration, so it's empty. So respiration is life without images. God breathed into man breath of life, and man became living soul. So to say that we dream or we have to dream, is that valid? Or do we have to live because we're endowed with life? That's more valid. And by living, we have option of replenishing our mechanism in the action, either at the unconscious level, which is unaware of how it's replenishing itself, or at the conscious level, and you're aware how it is replenishing it. Unconscious, you're not aware of how it does it. At conscious level, you are aware of how it does it. At the unconscious, you can pinpoint your respiration. You have no memory of what is going on when you're unconscious. You don't know if you're breathing. At the conscious level, you can pinpoint your respiration. So Paul is saying, I live and die daily. I rebuke you in your rejoicing, because we are rejoicing in the fact that we go to sleep and forget and get up next day and feel good. And he's saying that that's not valid, because he is going through the conscious process of revitalizing himself. And that's what you call living and dying daily in the Lord. the life principle is nurturing itself at the conscious level, and therefore it is not depriving him of his consciousness, whereas the other process of utilizing the life principle and having to shut down to feel, replenish, can fool you, and if it lets you down, who are you going to blame? You won't have anybody to blame because you can't come out of your unconsciousness to blame anybody. Do you see it?
I think it was Swami Kriyananda who said that, you know, he had this problem with sleep and that he didn't want to be addicted to sleep any longer. So one night he determined to keep his mind awake. And he walked around the grounds and he scolded himself and he managed to, what was it, change the thought patterns, change the mental fixation. And he said after that night he never had another problem with it.
Right.
So he changed the fixation.
Yeah. But the fixation is that you go to sleep because you got to go to school tomorrow. Where did you get your fixation in the first place? Remember, even though he's Swami Kriyananda, he still had to go to school for 18 years under the dictates of his parents, right? And he couldn't avoid that because why? They're going to be responsible for his behavior up to 18 years of age in the home, and it's their obligation to see him having an education. High school is required. Now, if you were living in another society where you're not obligated by any state or law to send a child to school, you wouldn't force him to go to bed at night. But because the law says he has to, then that is where the fixation comes from.
And his method in overcoming it is a valid method of dealing with
it. It was bad. Well, I put it this way. Once you know what you're dealing with, any method that works for you is valid. So find your own method and resolve it.
Now we know.
Thank you.
I'll go to bed.
Your own program.
Well, sleep now. I'm alive.
Meditate all night.
He just kind of rests in suspension right where he is.
Is he sleeping or is he in suspension?
He's suspension.
That's the interesting thing with a fish.
He's maintaining his equilibrium.
Right? Yeah, that's right, because he's in water, he's forced to. He's in the water.
Yeah.
A medium that is forcing him to learn suspended animation.
Mm-hmm. And this is so he sinks to the bottom if he.
Right. And therefore the yogi is teaching samadhi, the art of suspended animation,
mm-hmm.
by going back to the marine life process of his origin,
mm-hmm.
which is unification with life. That's why they use the word yogi. Well, we begin to see the rational science of the whole thing, what ancient man discovered about his mechanism between the different life forms as a cellular mechanism. He's really tapping at the replenishing principle on the conscious level. And that's his greatest contribution to himself, to tap the replenishing principle at the conscious level. Well, brother, how are you? Good to see you.
Good to see you.
Okay. Okay. Hello,
sister.
Okay. Yeah, tomorrow, good morning.
Good. You brought that nice weather with you.
Yeah. It's called the immobile state. It's the passion of the immobile.